Welcome to Voices of Today, a podcast for the Rochester Philharmonic Orchestra. I'm Julia Figueres. Today we wrap up our conversations with composer Derek Sky, discussing his companion piece to Beethoven's Ninth for the Rochester Philharmonic Orchestra. Welcome back, Derek. We have a title. This has been a while I've asked about that title, but we finally have one.
We do. We finally have one. Took a little while.
To seek is jubilance. Is the title the last thing you give a piece?
Often it is, yeah. Because when I'm writing the music, I'm often thinking about like a philosophical or conceptual like idea that usually when I'm writing the piece can just be best explained by like a paragraph's worth of information. Or like a conversation. And so then it takes me a while to figure out, well, how can I take that block of information and whittle it down to, a 2 or 3 or 4 word title.
I listened to your mock-up several times. And one of the things that struck me, and maybe I'm wrong here, was that I heard echoes of Beethoven in it. Did I properly hear that?
Oh yes, what that was 100% purposely done. Yes.
What part of Beethoven's choral symphony did you embrace to create To Seek His Jubilance?
Yes. So first the opening. The opening the I mean I've got actually electric guitar playing that arpeggiated figure there. And I was asked like, well, Beethoven 9 is going to be on the concert. You don't have to compliment it in some way in your piece, but we just, that's what the program is. And so, like, I had a choice of whether or not I wanted to kind of play along with that. And, but I was like, yeah, that's exactly what I want. Of course. Like, why not? Even in that piece, you can hear like French music and stuff like that. So I've saw no problem. I felt like that was quite a natural thing to do.
One of the things I noticed is the pacing is very similar in that it takes a very long time in Beethoven, of course, to bring in the soloists. It takes a bit before your soloists actually step in.
That's right. It takes almost 11 minutes. Yeah, 11 to 12 minutes before the soloists come in. I thought that that was a really good idea, both in his case and with what I was doing, because it allowed me, like, obviously I'm not he did a whole symphony, so it was like, I mean, not only was it the last half of the last movement that the choir and the soloists even come in, he had, 50 minutes of music before that that was without the choir. But in my case, it was like a half and half. But what I found was that you structurally, you're able to pack in more of an instrumental narrative because you know that you're going to bring the all of it back again. And it'll be fresh because the vocalists have come in and there's this, like, slight differences, but it'll be familiar. And so then it allows for like you to go to a lot more places because you know that like it's gonna come back. And so people won't be overwhelmed with the fact they're like, oh my God, there were all these places I can't even remember where I was,
There's also a sense of anticipation. You see these people on the stage, but they're not saying anything
You're
yet.
not saying anything. Yeah, I love
So you
that.
wonder, where is this going?
Yeah, you're always looking forward.
So you start very interestingly. You start with guitar.
Yes. I started the piece with electric guitar, an electric guitar solo, because I felt like that instrument historically was one of the biggest shifts musically that happened in the 20th century, because like all of a sudden the instruments were electrified. And it kind of started with, well, there was the theremin, but then also with the guitar. It kind of signaled the instrument, the history of the instrument kind of signaled a new age of making music using electricity. I think like the profound impact of like how the electric guitar has kind of like tied together so many different cultures at this point and so many different genres. I've always felt like that instrument should be a standard in the orchestra, that because it can change timbres and all of these. It reminds me of the organ, to be honest, like how versatile the timbres can be. And so I've always felt like, you know, well, if I just keep writing pieces that have electric guitar in there, maybe people just hire the electric guitar player and have them be like the bassoon player. Like, they're just there.
What other instrumentation did you put into To Seek His Jubilance that might be a little different, a little off the beaten track?
Yeah, so there's electric guitar, but there's also electric bass. There's a 5-string electric bass so that the player can hit the low C. The two reasons for having both of those electrified instruments, because I've also put electric bass in a lot of my other pieces, is it allows like there to be more like percussive elements in the lower tessitura of the orchestra. When you have electric bass, the articulations can be very tight. And so if you're doing something that's very groovy or very, very groove oriented, and you have that electric bass, like each one of those plucks is going to be like right there, right on it. And it then also frees up the contrabasses to be able to play a lot of melodic stuff with the cellos, which is something that I love so much. Then I also like don't want to leave like the roots of certain chords or these kind of inversions that I'm doing. And so if I've got that electric bass there to kind of hold down some of those pitches, then the contrabass and the cellos are free to do a bunch of cool melodic stuff that I just always love having happen. So it's me trying to be able to live and have the cake and eat it too.
Is this a signature move? When we listen to a Derek Skye piece, is there a signature moment or a signature use of instruments where people will say, yeah, that's Derek Skye?
I'd say so. Yeah, if there's an electric bass in there, that's probably me. I've always asked for electric bass so that the contrabasses can be as acrobatic as the cellos. And then because of the way that I use the electric bass for like grooves and articulated punctuations of chords for like the ends of like really crazy passages, I feel like people are like, oh yeah, that's.
And hand claps.
Hand claps, yeah. And then there's also chops, like chopping in the strings, you know, some extended technique stuff. And then I also love tuned gong. Love tuned gongs in the percussion section.
And what is that?
So tuned gongs are like these kind of like metal pots with that are tuned to different pitches. And then the tuning is like slightly different than equal temperament. And so it kind of creates a shimmer, kind of like gamelan, which is like music from Bali, Balinese classical music. And so that I love those pitches. It's just so... it's just gorgeous. It's like singing bowls almost.
We've talked about your music embracing all of your ethnicities from your ancestry. Is that part of it?
Oh, yes, always. I'm kind of always bringing that with me. But and then there's also stuff that where I'm not really, you know, it's not part of my ancestry, but it's just that music speaks to me. I'm just huge, wonderfully grateful that I can have it be a part of my life. So I also kind of let that be part of my language as well, or embrace that, or rather, to be part
embrace
of my language.
Embrace that. If you don't mind, let's talk a little bit about the use of Kiara's words.
Yes.
Picking up the poetry right now and how you used her poetry for this particular piece. And if you want, take a moment to once again read what Kiara wrote for To Seek His Jubilance. In the 21st century, a bullet might shove your future outside of you. So all that remains is the past, a photo of your last smile and the prayers they frame your name with. I soak myself in the thought, what is joy in the pursuit of happiness? If today my present is stolen and everything about me is past tense, I want my echo to sing that I sipped more joy than caution, the fear never suffocated my tomorrow, that I made happiness from instability and kept my hands open with kindness instead of filled with anger. I didn't wait to find nirvana. I pulled the stars toward me. I was never disillusioned that the end is what made the story. It was always everything leading up to it. The truth is the pursuit is where the joy is. An extraordinarily beautiful piece. And one of the things I noticed was that you took the section beginning with, I didn't wait to find nirvana. I pulled the stars toward me. And you repeat that. You go back to that. You cycle back to that. Why did you choose that section?
Yeah, that was so important, that part of it, because I think a lot of times that's kind of something that I know that I've done in my past, and like that a lot of times people just kind of catch themselves to do, especially when we're really, really busy. We're always kind of like, oh, well, if I just get to this next thing, or if I just get to this next thing, then I'll rest, then I'll be okay. If I just keep getting to this next thing, and then the happiness will come. There's this idea where like you're kind of, you just end up like a rat in a maze, or really in just a cycle where it's just completely just running in circles. And so it's this kind of moment where you could just like stop and pull that peace towards you, like in that moment, and not always feel like you need to wait for X, Y, and Z to happen until you can do that. I just thought that that was so powerful. That's one of my favorite parts.
The last word, and I will give it away, the last word is joy.
Mm.
The last thing that we hear, the last word we hear is joy, which is not the last word in the poem.
It is not.
Why did you decide put that there?
I think that that's a real struggle right now for people to find. I think, you know, when you look at our politics, and just, I'm just speaking specifically for the United States. Well, I guess it could be the world too, that there's a lot of transition stuff going on right now. So a lot of things are really kind of confusing. And then there's, you know, technology is going wild, and there's this anxiety. I think that a lot of people can feel that there's this anxiety that just seems to be everywhere. And everybody's like wondering if we're going to be able to, are we all going to be able to get along, kind of a situation. There's this idea that a lot of times it's really hard to think clearly about effective strategies in making sure that we're all getting along. If people are angry or depressed, that makes for a very difficult situation to figure out strategically how to make things better. So that being the last word of the piece before we kind of send everybody off to intermission to prepare for Beethoven is a situation where I can say like let's hold on to that. Like, let's hold on to that as we figure these things out, because it's only going to help. Like there's a saying that my wife and I talk about, Kim, she's so awesome, where we'll be, you know, trying to solve some problem or something like that, and we'll be like, well, I mean, we could be angry about it while solving the problem, but one, the problem's still going to be there and we're still going to need to solve it. So either we can be angry while solving it, or we can be joyful while solving it and then get it done. But either way, it still needs to be solved, and it's going to be there until it's solved. So it's like, how do you want to do the approach? Do you want to feel better dealing with it, or do you want to feel worse dealing with it? Yeah. So I think that that's really kind of where that comes from.
You put together this mock-up and you hit the send button. When you hit the send button, what does that moment feel like?
It's a big, deep breath. And well, I don't know if this is going to work, but we'll see what happens. You know, because every piece, you know, you're trying something in the music where you're just like, let's see how that happens. But that's part of the exploration of making new music, is you want to try something new. So that's certainly what's gonna, certainly what's, there's a couple of things in this piece that are very much like that. So we'll see what happens. So it's a big sigh, like, oh, okay, I've got it done. We'll see what happens.
Is there a piece in To Seek His Jubilance that you question?
Yeah, there's some stuff that I'm asking the first violins to do, that where, like, there's this running line that they have in their part where it's a cross between like Indian classical music, Persian classical music, and American folk music. And like each one of those styles of like fiddling and playing like happens in that line. And I'm like, ooh, and there's like slides and stuff in there. And I just keep thinking to myself, man, this is kind of like a little bit of a, it would probably be like a mini concerto for like a soloist, but I'm asking the whole section to do it. So I'm just kind of trying to figure out how that's going to go. I think they're going to have a good time, but I'm very interested in how that's going to sound and how that's going to work out. But, you know, Rochester Phil, that violin section is super good. So,
yeah, I was going to point that out. You're dealing with an orchestra that has a great violin section. You have a very talented orchestra. Have you ever been faced with an orchestra that maybe you had to, for lack of another phrase, dumb it down a little so the orchestra could get it done?
Oh, yeah. No, there's definitely been that case. Well, there is even another case where an orchestra had to pull one of my pieces off the program because there just wasn't enough rehearsal time to like get in into the meat of it. There have been some cases where I've had to like strip it down, but like that's part of the adventure of like trying new things in orchestra, because I mean, like Rite of Spring was almost impossible when he first, when that piece was, I mean, they had 9 months to rehearse the thing, so, which is like unheard of at this point in time. But now youth orchestras will play that, which is outrageous, right? And so a lot of times when I think about it, you know, there's a lot of professional composers, both in academia and kind of out in the wild, where the concept might be, well, you can make it hard, but you can't make it too hard because then no one will play it. But then that means the progress is slow. Like the moving forward of introducing new ideas into orchestral thing like slows down because you're like always afraid of it being too hard. But that's usually only the case is if you're thinking short term. Well, I want to make sure that everybody can play this thing while I'm alive. If you don't care and you're just like, okay, well, people will get to it when they get to it. And I don't care if it takes 30 years for people to like really get into the meat of it. Oh, I mean, so what? Like, that's why Rite of Spring sounds so good, right? That's why like Scriabin sounds so good. So it's just like, well, then it'll take 30 years. I'll see it in 30 years. Oh, well, that's fine. You know, but like the musicians are so good today that it doesn't take that long anymore to like get a piece to its kind of apex presentation.
Do you like To Seek His Jubilance? Are you happy with it?
Oh yeah, I love this piece. I was listening to it the other day. There's like, I have my like favorite parts and like all of these things. I'm very, very excited about this piece. There's like so many things in this piece that I'm trying for the first time, especially with the violin stuff. That I'm like very excited to see happen with the orchestra and the soloists and put together. And I'm really excited. There's like a couple of spots where it's like meditative, but it's not meditative in the way that some people might think. And I'm very much looking forward to those parts as well. So yeah, there's a lot of cool stuff in here, that some Northwest African like grooves in there, and with between the guitar and the bass and the orchestra. And when I write pieces, I'm always putting stuff in pieces where I just like, God, I wish an orchestra would do this. And then I'm like, oh, well, I'll just put it in there. So I'm always excited when I write a piece about of like hearing the piece and like loving the fact that like, oh, I put this one thing in there that I've always wanted to hear an orchestra do. And like, now we get to, I get to hear them do it, you know? So it's, I'm very excited about this piece and I like it.
I heard a lot of your African heritage, and I heard a lot of Middle Eastern heritage in this as well, more actually than in A Rage of Peace. This one felt particularly personal coming off of your pen. It felt like there was an awful lot of Derek invested in it.
That's funny. One of my mentors said the same thing. She heard that. She's like, this is very much you. And I don't know why that happened. I don't know. I mean, it could have been because of the concept of the piece. Like I've always been kind of contemplating a joy and the pursuit of happiness, I guess, if you will. And is it the pursuit that actually is the most enjoyable part that people don't often realize is the enjoyable part until like later? And I've always kind of loved that concept and loved that topic. And so Kiara's poem just kind of zoomed in on that kind of thing. And I just cannot help but like, that was a personal topic. It's a personal philosophical approach that like, I was going to squeeze that lemon and get all the juice out of it. So, it's definitely, there's definitely a lot of, yep, that sounds like Derek. That's what he would do. Yes, that is what I would do. And that's what I did.
What is the sensation like when you come to Rochester for the concert, and Kiara will be there too? What is the sensation like, Derek, when you hear that first note of your piece on that stage with that orchestra?
Yeah, well, usually before the first note, I'm terrified because I'm like, oh, great. Look at how many people up here and everything that's going to happen coming off that stage. Most of it is going to be my fault. So I'm like, so at first I'm looking up there like, oh, okay, here we go. And I often close my eyes before the first note. I see the conductor's hands go up and I'm like, okay, let's just go into it. And then right when that first note happens, I'm mainly just listening to the music because that's, you know, I in the past episodes, I explained to you my process of how it's really performance based. So the emergence of the music comes from playing. And so when I start to hear the music from the orchestra, all I'm thinking about is how it feels and how it sounds. And I'm always thinking about the mood and just like the music beyond the page, like right away. Well, and that's where the joy is for me.
What do you want us to take away? What do you want the audience to walk away with after they hear that last word, joy, and the last notes?
Yeah. The most extraordinary thing about Beethoven's Nine is the information surrounding Beethoven's Nine, like the kind of intention that he had for this to be like a celebration that everybody in the world could enjoy. I would think that in his time, you know, you could meet many people from the world, but not really the whole world, because it was just, there were limitations. There were communication limitations at that time. But now there aren't very many communication limitations, especially in comparison to that time. And so then you have this opportunity to write a piece to accompany another piece where the trajectory was trying to a large embrace for everyone. And I have this opportunity to be on this program with this piece. And I'm thinking, well, how can I do a large embrace for a lot of people have it sound that way and have it connect to people that are alive today, in which we do have these kinds of avenues of communication and being aware of one another on a very global scale. And so I went through this piece, and there's a lot of different cultural influences in this piece, because these cultural influences are part of me and part of all of us, because we have access to all of this, all of these things. And so my hope is that when people hear the last word, joy, and then they think about all of the rest of the piece that they've heard, and they think about how the interweaving of different vocabularies, different musical vocabularies have come together to kind of create this tapestry of music, and they hear that last word, joy, I'm hoping that they can think that that is a celebration. A celebration, not the celebration, but a celebration of the human experience that a lot of people could relate to, in particular today, because we have the ability to be aware of much more of our global population than in the time when Beethoven wrote Beethoven 9.
I want to thank you for creating this musical embrace. It's really an extraordinary piece. And I want to congratulate you for, I want to say a job well done, but for a gift so beautifully given. And I'm looking forward to hearing it from an orchestra.
Me too. Thank you so much.
We'll all be watching your face for that first note, and then we'll pay attention.
That sounds good. Absolutely.
Our guest today on Voices of Today, our awesome guest, has been Derek Skye. And many thanks for chatting with me. I'm Julia Figueres. Our director is Macon Dunn. Voices of Today is a production of the Rochester Philharmonic Orchestra.